You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 17th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Here I am. How's everyone?
Hello.
Good, thanks.
Rebecca is preparing for her paranormal road trip, which by the time the show goes out will have been done.
She claims she just got her driver's license about a week ago in preparation for this trip.
Oh, boy.
I'm not sure driving halfway down the United States is the best way
to... I think
to,
it's going to be hysterical. I mean, could you imagine all the things that she's going to say, like all the comments that she's going to come out with?
Yeah, like, what's that red octagon that says stop mean?
What is the sign that says stop mean? Yeah.
And she'll have two British guys with her giving her directions.
They'll say,
turn
on
the wrong side of the road.
Could you imagine?
We have a couple of interesting this day in skepticism or science news. The first is October 27th, 1780 was the first astronomical expedition of the United States. Observers left from Harvard College in Cambridge, Massachusetts to Penobscot Bay.
Penobscot.
Yeah, they were led by Samuel Williams, and they were there to observe an eclipse that was occurring that year. Interestingly, this was, you know, we were fighting a war with Britain at the time, but the British Navy allowed the scientists into the bay and to set up their equipment so that they could observe the eclipse.
That's cool.
Yeah. But there was a hitch. According to the expedition's calculations, they were trying to view totality, but they found that they were outside of the path of totality and a sliver of the sun was still visible even during the maximal eclipse.
So totality meaning a complete solar eclipse.
Yeah, yep. 100% blocked.
100% in the line.
But still, they made their observations.
Somebody screwed up.
It was successful to that extent.
But it was only, it was the first expedition, you know. I mean, that's pretty good for the first one.
They got,
for the U.S. They got better at it.
What else you got,
and
Steve?
In 1891, Philip B. Downing invented something very important. It was awarded a U.S. patent for,
Yes, the stuffing for pillows.
He made a design improvement to the street mailbox. He developed that little...
The flag?
Opening, the flap doohickey. So, you know, how you can drop the letter in, but you can't reach in there and pull letters out. And also obviously protects the letters from the rain and from the weather.
Oh, you mean the thing when you're doing a drop off of mail for the post office and you slip it in the slot and then you can't reach your hand in there.
Yes.
Because there's a piece of metal, like an L-shaped piece of metal that would block you. It would hold the letter until you put it down and then the letter slides down, safely depositing it into the box.
Correct.
Unfortunately, it does not protect against, say, bags of dog poop that get put into the mailbox.
Ah, lame.
By, you know,
people do that?
With bad senses of humor. Well, I'm saying is that, you know, people have been known to throw all sorts of objects in there, garbage and
yeah, it just keeps from taking stuff out.
Right.
Invented in 1891, still used today. A lot of longevity for that particular invention. Well, Jay, you're going to tell us about building computers, sort of, out of bacteria.
Sweet. Yeah, how impressive is that idea? But, you know, put simply, at its core, a computer processor does some very basic things that some scientists believe that they might be able to duplicate in bacteria. So a computer processor, as we know it, the kind that we have in our cell phones and our laptops and everything, manages a gigantic number of logic gates that are made out of electrical wiring, transistors, and integrated circuits. Logic gates have served us well. Every device we own, like I said, has at least one of these in them, including your car. If you have a modern car, it has a lot of processors in it. And I'd like to thank Jesus and Al Gore for both of those things.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, Gore.
Logic gates compare the bits or the ones and zeros in which computers encode information. So every logic gate has two or more inputs and one output. The output depends on the input and the operation the gate performs. And then as you string logic gates together, you can get to very complicated pieces of logic that determine the outcome of events and lots of different things. The interesting thing is that logic gates can be made out of tons of different things. So you could actually make a logic gate out of a series of pipes with plumbing and water going through it. You could make logic gates out of, you know, wooden levers and whatnot. You can make them, you know, large mechanical logic gates.
Jay, that reminds me of a discussion about artificial intelligence and consciousness. You know,
we think of room.
Yeah, well, you think about like having a computer brain that has the complexity and processing power of a human brain, and it seems intuitive that it can be consciously aware. It's like, okay, but what if you had, like, as you say, like, your logic gate, what was people using a slide rule, but you had 7 billion of them, and you had some way of coordinating and communicating among those people, and let's just say for hypothetical purposes, you can get to the point where you can although very slow, you could actually have a powerful supercomputer comprised of people using slide rules. Could that be conscious? It could process the same information, you know, that a silicon or whatever a computer can. So it's an interesting thought experiment. I think the answer is no, but I think substrate does matter in that context. But it does. Yes. It is dependent on this notion that anything could be a logic gate as long as you fit the minimum criteria of you have different inputs, one output, and you have some logic to it.
Well, to continue on, this was a very interesting bit of research that's being done. There's two people, Tae Siak Moon and Christopher Voigt, who's a PhD, and they're working on building logic gates out of genes. How cool is that, guys?
That's very cool.
It sounds a lot better than water pipes.
They made the largest genetic-based circuit to date. So this is what's going on. Moon is the lead author of an article that describes the project in the October 7 issue of Nature, and it's called Genetic Programs Constructed from Layered Logic Gates in Single Cells. The tiny circuits constructed from these gene gates could someday be components of engineered cells that will monitor and respond and interact with their very small local environment. The specialized bacteria could do powerful and specific things. This is what they were talking about in the article. They can clean up pollutants. They can excrete out biofuels. They can be infection control bacteria that might bustle around and kill pathogens. And there's dozens of other things that you could get bacteria to do that would be very helpful, beneficial, fighting disease, you know, just doing all sorts of different things. Now, one of the things that they were discussing is there's a couple of gates that are typical in all computing and anything that deals with a logic gate. There's an AND gate and an OR gate, right? They're two very different and specific things. So an AND gate, for example, turns on only if all of its inputs are on. So if it has two or more inputs, if all of them are saying yes, the logic gate is opened. An OR gate turns on if any of its inputs are on. So if one or more of the inputs is in the on state, the gate opens. And to simulate these in genes, Moon had to find a gene that would, say, be an AND gate. Its activation would have to be controlled by two or more molecules, not actually inputs. So the molecules or these binding molecules would actually become the inputs of the gate, if you can follow what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. If both molecules are present, then the gate would be turned on. And relax, Bob, not that kind of turned on.
If I can, Jay, so...
The
proteins are, they bind to promoter regions of DNA. So these are regions of DNA that regulate whether a gene is turned on or not, whether the gene gets transcribed and turned into protein. All you need to do is find a gene that has two or more promoter sites. If all of those sites need to be bound in order for the gene to make the protein, then you have an AND gate, essentially, and the output is the production of the protein.
That's right. So an example of this is a salmonella bacteria, or better known as the thing that causes food poisoning. Mm-hmm. And I've had it, and it's terrible. But anyway, so
can I just say, when I read that, I'm like, the organism that causes food poisoning, as if there's one. It's one of many bacteria that can cause food poisoning.
Good point.
You're right, of course, Steve. But that's the big one. That's the one everyone knows.
Yeah.
That's why they used it. The circuit Moon eventually built consisted of four sensors for four different molecules, like Steve was describing, that fed into two input AND gates. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if all four molecules were present and all three AND gates turned on and the last one produced a reporter protein that fluoresced red, so that the operation of the circuit could be easily monitored. That's cool. I mean, that's the biological gate is showing you that it's working. I thought that was really, really interesting.
Right down and to some, an indicator light. That's very cool.
Yeah, I know, right? Hey, your genes are blinking. Someday Moon imagines a synthetic bacterium that might detect four different cancer indicators and in the presence of all four, release something to kill the tumor.
Yeah. So you're actually programming a cell as like a drug delivery system that it will be able to detect with multiple inputs a situation in which, you know, the drug should be released. You know, like this is very likely to be a cancer cell.
So another thing, there were lots of things in their way to make this work, but one of the ones I found the most interesting is this idea that, you know, biological circuits could accidentally crosstalk with each other or get confused if they were in the region of another one. And part of that problem is that biology is really unorganized in a way, meaning that, you know, with electrical wiring, the precision is incredible. But in biology, there's lots of things floating around, even inside of a cell and everything. There's lots of moving parts and stuff like that.
It's messy. I mean, even evolution, I mean, receptor sites, et cetera, are not clean. It's not like 100% on or off. There's lots of related proteins and related receptors, and there's going to be some cross-reactivity. It's not clean.
Yeah, they call that crosstalk, and Moon had to eliminate this. And one way that he did it was he took three different strains of bacteria, and he took pieces of each one of them. And then what he did was he prompted the bacteria to reproduce, and he handpicked the ones that were least likely to crosstalk but still function. So basically he was, you know, looking for as he was forcing these things to reproduce, he was hand selecting the mutations that were in his benefit, which was another cool thing.
So he was creating this selective pressure himself.
Yeah.
You know, forcing the evolution of the bacteria into the direction that he wanted, which could be, you know, slow, but it's an effective way to go about doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I would find that probably to be common in situations like this where they're looking for mutations that have different properties and whatnot. And that's the way to make it happen. Moon said, "We're not trying to build a computer out of biological logic gates. You can't build a computer this way. Instead, we're trying to make controllers that will allow us to access all the things biological organisms do in simple, programmable ways. I see the cell as a system that consists of a sensor, a controller, which is the logic circuit, and an actuator. This paper covers work on the controller, but eventually the controller's output will drive an actuator, something that will do work on the cell's surroundings." So, like Steve said, this is all about not just detecting things, but actually reacting to the environment and doing things on that level. Very, very small, immediate, fast-moving level.
So if you're saying if the output is a creation of a protein, how does that speak to you know, how fast this thing is going to go about doing its business?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's not going to be doing it at computer speeds.
Right.
That's part of why you're saying this isn't going to be a computer. But that could still be fast in biological terms.
Yeah, especially if you've got, you know, many, many cells or bacteria, you know, performing this task. It wouldn't take long for something significant to build up.
So we'll see. Like any new idea, we could sit here and speculate about how it might be used, but how it actually gets used is probably going to be very different. But it is a neat basic concept. Let's go on to the next news item. This one really caught my interest. We talk about language a lot on the show. I mean, this is a podcast. It's made of words. So language is important.
Pedantic.
Yes, I have a bit of a fascination with this. This is a study looking at how people react to artificial languages. So they had their subjects. It was a very small artificial language that they made up for the study. And they wanted to see how the subjects would spontaneously alter or change the language depending on various situations. But before I tell you the results, let me give you a little bit of background. There's a few different hypotheses or theories about why languages are structured the way they are, and specifically why certain patterns or structures seem to recur in many different, even disparate languages. One possibility is that modern languages all have a common root. If you went back far enough in time, two seemingly disparate languages may have evolved from the same root language. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that there's something inherent in the way our brains work that guide languages in certain directions. And the third related to that is that there's an inherent logic to language that asserts itself over and over again as languages evolve. So this study was partly addressing that question are these patterns that we see in languages the same because there's a logic to how people use and evolve languages? And that is, in fact, what they found. So what the study shows, again, kind of makes sense, but it may seem like this is an obvious outcome, but, you know, when you put it into the context of our different theories about language, it makes more sense. What they found is that when the subjects were presented with ambiguous situations where the artificial language could not unambiguously describe the scene that they were being told to describe in the artificial language, they would add details, they would change the form of words in order to make it unambiguous, but they wouldn't do it otherwise. Specifically, they used the variable here is case. Case is the different forms of nouns that vary depending on what role the noun is playing in the sentence.
For example?
I'll give you some examples. So in English, actually, we do not use case very much. There's only a few cases in English. The main one that we use is the genitive case or possessive case. English has really just three cases, nominative, oblique, and genitive, right? But other languages have many different cases. They may have a different form of the noun for, you know, when the noun is doing the action, when the action is being done to them.
Which gender is saying it, or to which gender it's referring?
No, that's different. That's gender. That's different. That's different than case.
Okay.
I could run through them. There's nominative case, is it when the noun is the subject. Accusative case, when it's a direct object of a verb.
Okay.
Dative case indicates indirect object of a verb. Ablative case is movement from something. So if you're going from your house, you know, that's the ablative case. Genitive, which is possessive. Vocative case, which is an addressee, like, how you doing tonight, Evan? Locative, you know, we're at home. An instrumental indicates an object used in performing an action. You mop the floor with a mop. So in English, we don't use forms of the noun to indicate all those cases. We use word order or prepositions, you know, with, of, to. But other languages don't use word order. They have a fluid word order. So like if I say, Evan hit Bob. In English, that means Evan hit Bob. In other languages, that word order would mean nothing. And it could as easily mean that Bob hit Evan as Evan hit Bob. And you would know by the form of the nouns you use for Bob and Evan, which one was doing the action and which one was having the action done to him.
Hmm. Well, that explains some weird, ways that people who learn language, English as a second language, the way they construct sentences, because it's a new concept to them. And sometimes I try to make sense of why they use that particular word order. And that explains some of what I've heard. Interesting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like if you hear, say, Chinese speakers for whom English is a second language and they haven't quite mastered it, they don't know quite how to use prepositions properly because they don't use prepositions.
Yeah.
Or they don't quite get the word order correct. Yeah, because they're not used to thinking in word order and prepositions, where that's how we think about language. And we would be lost, you know, in a language that had a fluid word order until we mastered all those cases that don't even exist in English.
Ugh.
So what this means is that different languages found different solutions to the same problem of unambiguously indicating who is doing what in a sentence. Case, preposition, word order. Those are different solutions. So what the researchers did is they gave in the artificial languages they created, word order was fluid. So the speaker had to use case in order to indicate the different purpose that the noun was serving in the sentence. So what they found was that the speakers used case when only when it was necessary to make the sentence unambiguous, but then dropped it when it wasn't necessary. So they interpreted that to mean that they demonstrated there are two sort of logical imperatives in how people use language, and they extrapolated this to how language evolves over time, that we have a tendency to make language unambiguous and efficient. And we will use the most efficient construction that is still unambiguous. Obviously, we don't always do this all the time, but that's sort of the tendency within language to do that. And that explains also how languages evolve over time. We tend to shorten sentences. We tend to swallow consonants. Like, people make fun of the way we say the double T's. or the double D is like hidden instead of hidden, you know?
Right.
But yeah, but that, or written instead of written.
So we're just being efficient, that's all.
Yes. Well, this is a natural tendency in languages over time. You tend to swallow syllables. You tend to shorten words. Mm-hmm. If you don't lose any meaning, or if you, you know, if the resulting shortened sentence is, or word is just as unambiguous as the longer version, then there's no impediment to doing that. And therefore we'll do it. We'll take the shortcut. So language becomes efficient over time, but we also make changes in order to make it unambiguous. We'll add cases or prepositions or whatever. You find some strategy to render it unambiguous as well.
Well, so sure, because you want people to understand the point you're trying to drive home.
Yeah, but you don't want to say one more syllable than you absolutely have to.
Exactly. Right, efficiency.
So this,
why is that?
Well, I think you could think of it as like a genetic propensity to be more efficient, but yet unambiguous at the same time. And our languages reflect that.
Yeah, exactly. And so the authors also talk about the fact that it's, you know, we talk about being pedantic and, you know, keeping true to the correct original form, if you will, of a language. When in fact, they say it's good for languages to change over time. As languages evolve over time, they become more efficient and unambiguous. Let them change over time.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I bet you some people are going to disagree with that.
Well, I mean, I think we've said as much before ourselves, you know, that
yeah,
languages are living things, let them change. But you have to balance that against a certain amount of stability in the language so that people know what other people are saying. When I've thought about this, like, okay, when I'm going to be pedantic, it's when there is for the purpose of unambiguity. Is that a word? is when you're confusing different forms of the word or different uses of a word that actually obscure the meaning, mm-hmm. as opposed to this is just the right way to do it.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Hey, Bob, I'm sorry I hit you earlier in Steve's example. I hope it didn't hurt too badly.
I'm over it.
All right, well, Bob, you're going to tell us about some of the latest exciting exoplanet discoveries.
Cool. Yes, I am. And I'm sorry to say that my news item blows away all of your items, guys.
Hey, yeah, okay, great.
I'm just
thanks,
saying.
Bob. We love
just
it.
Saying. European astronomers announced on October 17th that they found an Earth-sized planet around another star. Big deal. Big deal, right? That happens all the time these days.
Nowadays.
Yes. But this planet was found around the closest star system to Earth, Alpha Centauri. How cool is
wow.
that?
Was that about 4.7 light years?
4.3, 4.4. I've heard both. Now, this is, the other cool thing is that this is overwhelmingly likely to be the closest exoplanet to Earth ever found. In a million years, they're going to say, yep, this is pretty much the closest one.
Well, unless there's a rogue planet that's out there, but I don't, how could we possibly have one that's closer? I don't think we could.
Yeah, I mean, unless it is a rogue planet, but this is going to be it, guys. I mean, this is going to be the closest one, and it's so exciting. Jeffrey Marcy, an exoplanet astronomer at the University of California, Berkeley, said, this is close enough you can almost spit there, which I thought was funny.
And, how many light years is it?
Right? That's a hell of a loogie if it's going to go 25.6 trillion miles. Yeah, 4.4, Jay. So this is a funny little quote. So before you get your hopes up, guys, so this planet is very close to its own sun. It's only about 4 million miles away compared to our distance. Earth's distance is like 93 million. And Mercury at its closest is 29. So this is even well within the orbit of Mercury. So that means the surface is going to be somewhat inhospitable to carbon-based
lava.
Life.
Yeah, Bob, I was going to say that if this were in the Goldilocks zone and it were an Earth-sized planet, then absolutely your news item would be the best. But come on, it's really close to its star. It's inhospitable to anything that we would recognize as life.
Right.
Totally inhospitable. I mean, we're talking 2,200 degrees, and that means that there's, like we said, really not going to be any life unless it's something really
lava
bizarre.
Man.
Like those rock lava creatures from Star Trek. Remember those dudes with the claws?
Maybe something
the
like that.
The Horde Albions.
The Horde. Yeah. If it raised the possibility.
Not the Horde, the other one with the Lincoln. You know, remember Lincoln and Serac? They made good versus evil battle.
The rock
But yeah, that was really disappointing.
But we're not going to be having a conversation with Alpha Centaurans anytime soon.
That scuttles the whole thing. So they found, you know, the planet that's way too hot. And what's the point then?
Well, all right. There's a couple points. First off, the information, what they learned and just the Alpha Centauri system itself is really fascinating. And I'll tell you about it if you're interested. I don't care if you're not interested, but the planet is, this is the lightest least massive planet they've ever found, 1.13 times the mass of the Earth, which is, I mean, that's in terms of mass anyway, if they're correct, this is very close to Earth mass. Its year is only 3.2 days long, which
that thing is whipping around fast.
Oh man, yeah. Now, since Rebecca's not here, I'll make fun of her. If she lived on that planet, she'd be about 3,500 years old, which is such an amazing 3.2 days is the year. It's just like mind boggling. And even
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
But even Alpha Centauri, even Alpha Centauri is fascinating, I think, system for lots of reasons. Not only because it's the closest one, but it's a triple star system. Which looks at, if you look at the constellation Centaurus in the southern hemisphere, which we can't see, it looks like one big bright star because it, obviously because the three stars kind of just merge into one to the human eye. Now the planet that they found was found orbiting one of these stars, namely Alpha Centauri B, which is slightly smaller and I think about half as dim as our sun. Alpha Centauri A is a little bigger and brighter than our sun. It's funny how our sun is kind of like right in between those two guys. Now, A and B are in an 80-year orbit around each other, separated by about 9 billion miles. Now, that may seem like a lot, but Alpha Centauri C is the weirdo in the group. This is a dwarf star orbiting its bigger sisters from about a trillion miles away. It's really, really far away from these guys. But this is the reason why it's called Proxima Centauri, since its orbit makes it the closest or most proximate star to our sun. So that Proxima Centauri is the star that is the closest to the sun. You also might recognize Alpha Centauri for other reasons. Maybe because it contains the planet Cybertron, which is the homeworld of the Transformers. The blue-skinned Na'vi from Avatar also live there. And if you ever journey there, you may pass by the Lost in Space crew who are desperately trying to find this star system. So if you do, please give them directions. I don't think they ever found it. And if you are actually thinking of going there or sending a probe, I think it's obvious you should reconsider because it would take about 40,000 years to get there using our lame non-science fiction rocket technology. But if you did get there, the planet would have some very interesting similarities and differences to Earth. Most of the constellations would be the same, right? Since it's so close to us, right? It makes sense that a lot of our constellations would be similar, like the Big Dipper and Orion, for example. Also, if you were on the planet and not burning to death, you would notice that conventional night and day would also exist. When stars A and B are on one side of the planet, you would have night and day, just like we know. But during those times when the planet's in between those two stars, one side would experience a kind of like a very bright twilight, like everything was illuminated by the, you know, big stadium floodlights. Now, even the story how they found this was fairly interesting. They used the tried and true radial velocity method, which we've talked about on the show before. This method measures the gravitational tug of a planet onto its parent star, which imparts a kind of small acceleration to the star, making it go kind of back and forth. And this acceleration of the star Doppler shifts the light, changes the frequency of the light that's coming to the Earth, which we can see once we remove all the other sources that could be confused for the same thing. And it was really difficult to actually pull this, you know, to tease this information from the star because there's so many different things going on in that star. They had to really subtract everything that wasn't based on the tug of the pull of this planet. And so it was very, very subtle. The tug in Alpha Centauri B was only about 1 mile per hour, or 20 inches a second, which would really be like a really relaxing walking speed. I mean, it's such a minor tug. In fact, this is the smallest wobble the Swiss team has ever recorded. I think it might actually be the smallest wobble ever recorded, although I couldn't confirm that. And the recorded data that they got was actually so sensitive that the team could see sunspots on the star and even the disturbances caused by giant solar flares. The data was very detailed. You know, you may be disappointed that there's most likely no life on this planet, but remember though, and this gets to you guys saying, what's the big deal? Remember that 70% of all small planets that we've found have other planets as well.
Well, so, that was going to be my next point, is how many other planets do we know exist in this system?
Astronomer and paper co-author Stefan Udry of the University of Geneva said, finding in our closest neighbor a one-Earth-massed planet really opens up the prospect for finding planets there in the habitable zone. So that's really the big takeaway here, is that now that we're refining our techniques, hopefully they'll be able to look in the habitable zone and trying to find Earth-sized planets or bigger, maybe you know, what do they call those mega Earths or super Earths in the habitable zone? Yeah. And that would be tremendous. Now, it would be very unfortunately the way the stars are oriented now. It's not really an optimal time to do this kind of research. So it might be a few years before they could really do a deep dive into this and see what else is there. But they might find it. So in a few years, we may find one day that in Alpha Centauri, there's an Earth-sized planet far enough away from its sun for liquid water and perhaps for life to exist. And chances are they won't have blue skin or robot skin or wear silver jumpsuits. But even if it's Centauri bacteria, it would be awesome. So I'm looking forward for them to actually look a lot deeper into this in the near future.
All right. Well, Evan, you're going to tell us about the guy who hacked his way into U.S. Defense Department computers in order to find evidence of aliens.
And this particular story dates back to 2002. 2001, actually. So this is a long-standing, continuing saga. And the headline I read from Slate reads as such. The United Kingdom will not extradite the alien-hunting hacker with Asperger's who broke into NASA and military computers. So let me explain what this is all about. The gentleman's name is Gary McKinnon, and he's a Scottish-born systems administrator and a hacker who was accused in 2002 of perpetrating what's known as the biggest military computer hack of all time. Now, McKinnon, in his defense, states he was merely looking for evidence of free energy suppression and UFO cover-up activity and other sort of similar technologies and pieces of evidence that would be potentially useful to the public. So that he says that was his motivation. And using his hacker name Solo, which is kind of a cool name, McKinnon allegedly hacked into almost 100 U.S. military and NASA computers and some private company computers as well over a 13-month period between February of 2001 and March of 2002. The U.S. authorities claim he deleted critical files from operating systems, which shut down the U.S. Army's military district of Washington and their network of 2,000 computers for the better part of a day. And McKinnon at the time posted a notice on the military website in the middle of all this stating, "Your security is crap."
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Wow.
So, definitely. Yeah. You know, he was arrested. He was arrested by British police in London in March 2002. And since that time, he and his lawyers have been fighting all attempts to have him extradited to the United States of America. The charges standing against McKinnon are 8 counts of hacking U.S. government computers and private company computers. The sentence for such a crime is as severe as life in prison. However, in 2008, this story takes a big twist. After years of appealing and being denied by various British courts, including the House of Lords, the European Court of Human Rights, which seemed to be McKinnon's final chance to avoid an extradition, that court denied his appeal. Now, upon losing that appeal, McKinnon's lawyers revealed that Gary suffered from Asperger's syndrome. So for the first, 6 years of this story, this was unknown and it was finally revealed. So his lawyers were arguing that therefore the extradition would be inappropriate and an endangerment to his health. So this opened a whole new chapter into this particular person's trial for extradition.
Yeah, but it sounds like it sounds like, Evan, it wasn't so much the Asperger's as the fact that they feared that he would become suicidal. And that risk was out of proportion to the punishment. So extraditing him, would be then unjust. Because
right.
Of suicidality. Not necessarily specifically for the Asperger's.
Well, is there a connection between Asperger's and suicide? That was actually going to be one of my questions kind of later in the piece. But Steve, if you have some, do you know anything about that? Is there any evidence of that?
I mean, there's no direct connection. There may be a higher risk of depression in Asperger's. Mm-hmm. I don't know, actually. I didn't explore that angle. But
yeah.
They're not directly related. There may be an indirect relationship.
Not directly related, right.
The other point they brought up was that his Asperger's was part of the reason why he hacked the computers over and over and over again.
Yeah.
He was sort of obsessive about in his pursuit of this information. And so they're trying to mitigate his guilt because of the obsessive nature of the Asperger's. So that's more where it comes in.
But
as well.
Steve, do you find that to be a valid excuse? I mean, if he's still performing dangerous behavior, compromising government systems and things like that, I don't care what his problem is.
Well, you know, Asperger's, in case, for those who don't know, is a mild, if you will, form of autism.
Wide spectrum, right, Steve? I mean, a lot of
people
can fall on
that. Well, it was added to the autism spectrum disorder, you know, basically at the mildest manifestation end. These, you know, you probably know people who fit into this category. Somebody who, they do tend to gravitate towards
skeptical
hobbies and
conferences.
Careers. That fits the profile of a computer programmer, somebody who could focus their attention, is very bright, who could do that kind of a technical task and doesn't mind spending lots of time by themselves, you know.
Yeah, pretty much all my hobbies, right, Bob?
Yeah, right. In fact, I remember reading a story about the guy that the first guy that coded BitTorrent. He, you know, very gifted programmer, very, very gifted. Obviously, he was the first to come up with that whole idea. And he, I remember his wife in the article saying that he was just obsessed. He would spend, you know, 10 hours at a time, nonstop, just coding and coding and coding. And look, you know, look what he did. I mean, it was just an amazing, it's an amazing utility that I remember reading that, you know, BitTorrents at any one time are taking up a surprisingly significant fraction of all the internet bandwidth.
Guys, do you find it though interesting at all that the lawyer chose to only reveal this as part of a defense only after what seemed to be kind of his final chance to avoid extradition? And why didn't this come out in 2002, 2003, or any of the other various lower courts that were hearing this? And why is this the first time we're hearing about it?
I think it's like an ace in the hole. You know, he was saving that for when he really needed it.
That's what I was thinking too.
But he could say it was, you know, to protect his privacy. We didn't want to reveal it until we absolutely had to. You know, he could make a reasonable case for it.
Well, and they could test him, Ev, to see if he is suffering from it. You know, I mean, it's not like they couldn't validate it if they wanted to.
Well, what this did to the case is like I said, it took a twist. So in early 2009, McKinnon actually signed a confession, and he submits it to another piece of the British government, part of the British government called the Crown Prosecution Service. In one last attempt to escape having to stand trial in the U.S. court, basically signing a confession saying, yes, I did this stuff, but let me be tried in Britain. Do not send me to the U.S. courts where they're going to, you know, be much, apparently much harsher on him than he would if standing trial in Britain. And, the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, actually, denied that request. And it looked like he was heading to the United States. But at this point, this has become a hot political issue and, you know, was reported widely, and human rights groups get involved in so much. And the pressure was on the British government, and it wound up putting the extradition on hold until it could review and take into account this new psychological evidence, which, you know, seems like, you know, that's the way it goes. So in January 2010, a British High Court grants judicial review, and that effectively marked the beginning of the end of any extradition. And just recently, as the headline reads, the British government has officially now ceased all efforts to extradite McKinnon. So the story intersects with skepticism in some obvious ways, and you could classify this particular story in a lot of different ways. I think you could classify it under the heading of how pseudoscience and belief in nonsense is, in this way, dangerous. I mean, you know, no one died as a result of McKinnon's actions. That's a fact, okay? But it's this modern culture has become so saturated with the belief that extraterrestrial crafts and creatures have or are visiting the Earth. It's not a benign idea.
It foments distrust in the government and conspiracy
it sure does.
Mongering, conspiracy thinking. So it's not a healthy thing. But the other thing, though, it did reveal a massive vulnerability in the infrastructure of our Defense Department in terms of being protected from cyber attacks. I'd rather have it be a ultimately harmless conspiracy nut who cracked into our defense system as opposed to like a terrorist organization.
Well, of course. I mean, he didn't. But Steve, I agree with that, but at the same time, he still did some real damage.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't mitigate his guilt. Just, you know, if you're looking at the consequences. I mean, he is the kind of guy, he should be hired as a white hat hacker who's testing the vulnerability of systems. I mean, that would be a good job for him. It's too bad he didn't do that.
Yeah, I wonder how relevant his skills are now. I mean, we are going back, you know, 8, 9, 10 years when he did this, and, you know, security has changed a lot in that time. I wonder if he could still even pull off something like that, considering the advances that I assume, you know, our military systems have gone through in the intervening time.
I would hope.
Well, God, you would hope so. Plus, remember also when this happened. It's all around the time of 9/11.
It's right after 9/11.
Right after 9/11. So you know, the U.S. government was not messing around with anything at that point. They were taking every bit of this as serious as possible.
They were not in a good mood at that time.
No, we're not in any kind of mood.
Well, they wouldn't be today either, though. I mean, of course, things became a lot more severe after 9/11, but even still, I mean, I think if he did this before 9/11 with the amount of damage that he did, keep in mind, guys, it was the biggest hack against the U.S. government ever.
Cybersecurity remains a huge issue for all the world governments, you know, and also any institution, industry, whatever, with a vulnerable infrastructure. It doesn't have to be a government. I mean, think about hacking into nuclear power plants, you know.
Or Sony or MasterCard to get all their credit card information, user credit card information.
It's a huge issue. Absolutely huge.
Huge issue.
Yeah, that's one of those things that I find that are a little scary, and I think it's one of those areas we really need to be one of the world leaders in that type of thing, because it's just so scary to think that we could be hacked, and, you know, like nuclear power stations, what the hell? I mean, they could have their way with that, or even our military infrastructure. Wow.
Yeah,
I really hope that they're really just putting tons of money and research.
They are, Bob. And, they are.
They're trying to keep up with it hard.
The fact that we've thwarted, you know, hundreds of thousands of attempts and everything. I mean, we're doing it successfully right now. It's just things get scary as technology increases. Everything that we are goes online. We're going to enter the cloud. Everything that you are is going to be in a computer somewhere. You know, right now you can think about in your smartphone how much of your life is in there already, but imagine where anything about you is going to be online.
Unless you go off the grid, man.
Yeah, but.
Yeah. That's right.
It's going to.
Bear skins and stone knives.
It's already gotten to an incredibly personal level, but what happens when every computer you own is just a terminal that's just your window into your files and everything about you that's up in the cloud, and then people can hack into your personal stuff? That's really scary.
Let me take a quick second though to clarify sort of a distinction, and this is something that I've had to learn over the years, because I've expressed my I've been pretty opinionated in the past about hacker culture. I've been outspoken about it, and of all the opinions I've expressed, I've actually been taken to task pretty harshly in stating in the past how I've had problems with hacker culture, but I've refined my thoughts, and in light of being better educated, as any good skeptic does, I've learned now to disagree only with the behavior of illegal hacking, that there is actually a legitimate aspect to hacking. They call it online ethical hacking, and it's an actual term. It's a legitimate term, which refers to security professionals who apply their hacking skills for defensive purposes, and people who are hired for their services, definitely, you know, to take down these companies, so that the or private companies or governments and whatnot, so that they can see where their soft underbelly is and help plug those holes. I think that's a very, very positive aspect.
Yeah, the term hacker does not imply illegal. There are different types of hackers. That's just to make that clarification.
I think there's something really cool and badass about people that take the time and energy to, in amazingly clever ways, break into computer systems and everything. I mean, there's an art form to it.
Right.
Well, Evan, it's time once again for Who's That Noisy?
It is. And due to our, revised recording schedule that we have this week, I'm going to be playing for you the new Who's That Noisy. And in a future episode, we're going to be doing the reveal for not only the prior week's Who's That Noisy, but also for this week's Who's That Noisy. So, everyone follow that? Good, because here we go. Who's That Noisy? Name it.
Suddenly, mitosis takes place. The DNA strand separates in a dazzling display of color.
Whoa.
Love it. I love that.
All right.
Gotta love those old science recordings, or mockery thereof, whichever the case may be.
I think you're on to something. So I have a feeling we'll get more than one correct answer on this one. Be the first by emailing us at info@theskepticsguide.org or posting on our forums, sguforums.com. This is a fun one. So enjoy it, and good luck, everyone.
And to clarify, we are recording our next two shows at SciCon. So the reveal for last week and this week's Who's That Noisy will be in 3 weeks as the podcasting time is reckoned.
There you go. Thank you for that calendar, Steve.
Okay. We're going to do one email this week. If you guys all seen the first episode of the new season of The Walking Dead?
Of course.
Silly question.
Great.
No, but that's okay. We'll talk about it anyways.
So this is a spoiler alert.
Little spoiler alert.
That's okay. I'm good with that. I can do
it. And remember, if you buy the Walking Dead trading cards, you might be lucky enough to get an original and unique drawing of the members of the SGU in zombie form. But on to the question. This comes from Henry Liu, and he writes, "Hey guys, I got a fun medical question for you all, and maybe a little bit more aimed towards Dr. Novella due to his medical background. If you've seen the new season of The Walking Dead, in the first episode, the old guy gets bitten on the leg, and the main character decides to amputate his leg because he thinks it's like a venomous snake bite. The rationale is even though they all know they're all infected already, that zombie bites cause a secondary infection that makes you sick and you die, thereby allowing the primary infection to turn you into a zombie. Is the choice to amputate really stupid, even if the infection was like a venomous bite? You would think they made a relatively moderate problem of a huge bite into an enormous problem, given that there's going to be massive blood loss now. Chance of incidental infection, and well, the old guy is really old, and he probably can't take the shock of getting his leg hacked on repeatedly by a hand axe. If they intended to cauterize the amputation later, wouldn't it have been better to just cauterize the huge bite wound instead and hope that would be enough? It seems like anything they could do to help the amputation, they could have done to the bite wound, and it wouldn't have been as bad. Dr. Novella has talked about in medicine that usually treatments have risks, but the benefits outweigh the risks. In this case, I'm wondering if the amputation is causing more damage than it's helping, given their fictional situation. Thanks, Henry Liu.
Well, there's a few things we have to ask. Like, first, if you get bit by something, anything, and it has a highly infectious contagion in it, how quickly is that going to get into your blood and travel up your limb or whatever, right?
So, I'd say almost instantaneously, right?
No, it's not, I wouldn't say instantaneously.
The traveling, the infection would happen instantaneously, but to travel your system, that would take time.
So there's two different kinds of things that bites can get into your system. Some kind of venom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or
bacteria.
Or some kind of infection.
Or a virus, yeah.
Yeah, virus or bacteria. And they would, you know, be in different rates. You know, a snake bite, for example, a venomous snake bite, that's sort of evolved to be efficient in spreading quickly, getting into your blood system. It can have local effects or bad, but it also then can get into the bloodstream and have systemic effects, which are usually worse, like paralysis, you know.
Neurotoxin.
Yes. Yeah. Bacteria and viruses, there's a couple of factors here that we have to consider. It's not just how quickly they get into your bloodstream, but also the local tissue, but also how much of it. You know, it's also about the dose. The inoculum, you know, how many bacteria are we talking about? Your immune system can fight off small amounts of infection or keep it at bay, but a high enough inoculum, you know, too many bacteria or viruses all at once will overwhelm your immune system and then establish an infection, maybe even a blood infection, a systemic infection, and that's where you're really in trouble. Certainly, hacking off a leg to prevent a garden variety bacterial infection from a mouth wound is not the way to go. You would have been better off just cleaning the wound.
Hmm.
And yes, may have gotten some bacterial infection, maybe even some septicemia, you know, some bacteria in the blood. But if you cleaned it quickly, probably would have minimized that. Then you would, you know, give them antibiotics. I don't know if they have antibiotics. And part of the reason why they're where they are in this episode is they're hoping to score some supplies, including possibly some medical supplies. So, you know, maybe they could just have cleaned it, stopped the bleeding, tried to, if they either had already a supply of antibiotics or gotten a supply, that would have prevented the bacterial infection. The real, I think, ringer here is the zombie virus itself. We don't know a lot about it, but what's been established in the series so far is that the virus is everywhere and everyone is infected with it, so that if you die from any reason, you within a minute, you're coming back as a zombie. So the virus is obviously already in the system. You don't have to die from a zombie bite in order to turn into a zombie.
But that zombie bite will kill you, though. That's the thing. He would have slowly died from whatever, like being overwhelmed by the virus.
Right. So does the zombie bite, though, does that kill you because it just gives you a nasty infection, because you bleed, you go into shock, or is it because you get a high enough dose of the virus all at once? Maybe the chronic infection that everyone has is a low level, the virus is almost dormant, It's not really doing anything, but it will be activated once you die. But the, if you get a bite, you get a huge bolus of virus that then sets up an infection that kills you and turns you into a zombie.
But Steve, you're dancing around the thing here. Like, first off, I don't accept the idea that they could have just washed out his wound and he would have been okay. For some reason, that seems a little counterintuitive. I mean, I think that they've learned through experience that you get bit, even if it's not a really deep wound. I mean, you get bit and it's going to kill you.
Yeah, so that, but that's what I'm leading up to, Jay. All these variables matter to the ultimate question of should he have chopped his leg off or not. If we take the premise that a zombie bite introduces a large bolus of virus that will, even if you're already infected, the extra virus is enough to cause a fulminant infection that kills you and turns you into a zombie, then that's at least a rationale for hacking off his leg in order to prevent that from happening. And then what we don't know is how quickly does the virus get into your system? And that depends on the properties of the virus, which are not really known, you know, to any kind of certainty by the characters in the show or by the audience watching it. We just don't know the answer to that. It's certainly, you know, you talk about risk versus benefit here.
Hmm.
If they know from experience that the zombie bite will inevitably lead to a rapid death and zombification, then you actually have nothing to lose by cutting
right.
the leg off because he's dead anyway.
Or and if he turns into a zombie, it's a hobbled zombie and you can run away from it.
Of course, Evan. You're so insightful.
So, but there's a 1% chance that cutting it off very quickly may prevent, you know, him from dying from the bite wound and turning into a zombie. Then it was worth it because the only other possibility is a 100% chance of death and zombification. So,
in this case, you know, they cut the guy's leg off below the knee. That's such a massive artery that you're cutting into.
Well, they did show him tying off the leg with the belt first. That's something. It wasn't enough to stop the bleeding, but it probably slowed it. They needed to really tie it a lot tighter, I think, like really tourniquet style. They needed to tourniquet his leg off. They didn't do that. They just sort of tied it.
Yeah, but then that type of wound, I'm curious to see what happens in the next episode, though, but that type of wound needs surgery. You can't just cauterize that. That's not going to stop it.
So what happened? Did they go kind of hopping away with this guy and go on?
No,
it was the
end of the episode. It was the end of the episode.
Oh, we don't know where it goes.
It took like 6-7 hacks to get his leg off.
That was nasty.
He went unconscious from the pain and the blood loss and shock. And that was the end of the episode. There was something else happened there, but we don't need to throw another spoiler in.
I think that he's going to die from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a high probability of dying. Now, let's say they can stop the bleeding with more tourniqueting of the leg and they get antibiotics, they keep an infection from happening. That's a really rough wound. I mean, when you do a surgical amputation of a wound, you don't just hack it off or saw it off. You create a muscle flap and you are very careful with how, you know, you have to make sure you feed the flap with arteries. It's a delicate procedure to get a good stump. He's going to have a horrible stump, if he does survive all of this to the point where, and he's the only doctor that they have access to right now. So,
assuming nothing gets infected, I mean, isn't a wound like that horribly subject
to
infection?
Yeah, he just picked an axe up off the floor and hacked his leg off. I mean,
forget it.
I mean,
there's
no question that he has an infection. That's not the question. The only question is how bad is it and will they have access to antibiotics?
See, I don't know. Would I want to be hobbled on one leg and survive in a world in which I'm escaping from zombies? It's almost like, let's just get it over with.
The other bit
better
here
than
is,
that than dead.
this is their doctor. And the guy who hacked his leg off, his wife is pregnant and ready to pop. And he said, we need our doctor alive. He needs that guy alive for his wife. And that's why he did this desperate act to keep him alive, even without a leg.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Good luck, pal.
Better you than me?
All right. Well, thanks for the question, Henry. Evan, before we go on to science or fiction, you have a quick announcement.
I just wanted to let the audience know that I had the opportunity to participate on a television program called The Tricia Show recently, and I was on there as the skeptic who was putting up the points against some psychics that they had on the show. And this is a nationally televised show. It's a daytime show, so check your local listings. It's going to air on October 31st in the morning in most markets, and you should just go ahead and check your local listings for that. I was only on the show for just a few minutes, but I think my participation in it was worthwhile and got some good points in, and we're going to see what they do to it in editing. It'll be interesting to see, and hope you enjoy it, and watch it when you can. Set your DVRs and tell a friend.
And since we're doing our announcements, it's come to our attention that we have been nominated for the 2012 Stitcher Podcast Awards. You can go to stitcher.promotw.com and click on the 2012 Stitcher Awards. Apparently, you can vote once a day, every day, until November 5th. The Skeptic's Guide is nominated in the science category, as you might expect. So we always appreciate the support of our listeners. And now, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And I ask my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have a theme this week and four items.
Ooh,
I'm sorry, Rebecca is not here to enjoy this one.
Three participants, yeah.
Here we go. The theme is the hagfish.
There's a hagfish?
That's the theme.
A hagfish?
Yes, the hagfish.
Okay.
Item number one. The hagfish can rapidly produce as much as 20 liters of slime as a defense against against predators. Item number two. The oldest fossil hagfish is 300 million years old and shows remarkable similarity to modern hagfish, demonstrating unusual evolutionary stability. Item number three, molecular analysis has confirmed that hagfish are transitional between vertebrates and invertebrates. And item number four, hagfish are the only creatures known to have a skull but no vertebral column. Bob, go first.
20 liters of slime. I admire that ability. It's true. I wish I could do that. But 20 liters does sound like an awful lot. I'm not sure how big hagfish are.
And these are, they're small creatures. I mean, you can hold one in your hand. It looks like an eel that's maybe 1 to 2 feet long.
Still, 20 liters sounds huge, unless it could take in water and then slimify it and then expel it. I can't imagine it being able to produce that much or have it on hand ready to go. Let's see. Number two, they found a fossil that's 300 million years old. Okay, so it's very stable. Yeah, I can kind of buy that one. Lots of examples of that kind of stability. Sharks haven't changed much in many millions of years as well. So it's number three, it's transitional between vertebrates and invertebrates. Oof, I never heard of that one. Transitional. Number four, it's the only creature known to have a skull but no vertebral column. I can't imagine. For that to happen, I would think it would have had to have had vertebrae but then somehow lost it. But I mean, could it have changed to cartilage, but yet keep the skull? Wow.
And therefore,
all that time I spent reading news items. Well, I can't say it was wasted. I can't say it
no,
was
it's
wasted,
never,
but it's
never wasted.
But it won't help you here.
Wish I could just send an email to myself. Bob, read about hagfish.
Hagfish.
You bastard.
Bastard.
I think I'm just going to go with the slime. It just seems like 20 liters just seems like too much. Even if you're sucking in water, and you can't turn water into slime that fast.
Right, so slime is the fiction.
I don't think. Yeah, so slime is the fiction.
Okay, Evan?
Am I the only one here who doesn't know what a hagfish is?
I've heard of it, but I really can't even picture the damn thing.
Hagfish. I've never even heard of it. Hagfish are transitional between vertebrates and invertebrates. You know, I've got nothing to go on there. Is sure. Why not? One of many, probably, you know. I mean, transitional is, you know, I don't see any reason why it couldn't be that. So I'll say that one's science. The oldest fossil, 300 million years old. Okay. Remarkable similarity to modern hagfish. Okay. Nothing special there, I don't think. Demonstrating unusual evolutionary stability. Okay. So I am not seeing anything there that's striking a strange chord in me. I'll say that one is science. So 20 liters of slime, that's a lot of slime. And hagfish, the only creatures known to have a skull but no vertebral column. Well, if the one about the skull is going to be the fiction, perhaps it's basically not the only creature to have it. So, but 20 liters of slime, Bob, boy, you're right. That's a lot of slime and rapidly produce something so small. trying to think of another animal that's small that can produce a lot of defense sort of liquid or goo or whatever.
My ex-wife.
I keep thinking of snakes and spitting cobras and that kind of stuff. And they put out like streams of stuff, but not 20 liters. 20 liters is too much. So I will put my nickel down with Bob and say that the slime
G-W-B.
Is the fiction.
All righty, Jay.
You know, the only one that I was feeling like is 100% sure is the slime one. I don't think it produces 20 liters of slime. I think it excretes something that just reacts with water. It makes like a gelatin.
Wish I thought of that.
It's no way that it has 20 liters of anything inside of it unless the thing is gigantic.
As I said, you could hold it in the palm of your hand.
Then, okay, so there you go. So if it's doing that, then it's definitely just got some type of reactive whatever, which is the only one of all of these that I can make sense. The second one is about it being a 300-million-year-old and shows that it has a lot of evolutionary stability. All right, so I, you know, 300 million years is a long time. Is there anything alive that hasn't changed that much in 300 million years? I'm sure a lot of people have a lot of different answers on that, but is this fish one of them? The molecular analysis that confirmed transitional between a vertebrate and an invertebrate. All right, well, I don't see why I wouldn't believe that. I mean, I could believe that it is transitional. And the last one about the hagfish are known to have a skull but no vertebra column. That's kind of odd, isn't it, Bob?
Yeah.
I mean, it has a skull, but it's sitting on top of what? But don't all fish, like, aren't fish bones mostly cartilage? These are all really good questions, and I don't have any of the answers. Because I'm not a fishologist. Thank you.
And ichthyologist? Ichthyologist.
Okay, so I'm going to say that I'm going to believe the slime. I'm going to believe that it's the oldest fossil and the molecular one. I'm not going to believe that it's 300 million years old. I don't think anything lasts that long. Unusual evolutionary stability for 300 million years? I don't think so. That's the fake.
Okay. Guess I'll take these in reverse order. You all agree that hagfish are the only creatures known to have a skull but no vertebral column.
Steve, do me a favor. Just say I lost. Just tell me now. They'll make me suffer through all four of these.
You have to suffer. Okay. I will say that, interestingly, if you think about it, 2, 3, and 4 are all kind of related.
Yeah.
If it is 300 million years old, that means that's the right time for it to be transitional, and it kind of would make sense that it would have part of what vertebrates have. Those all can kind of fit together. But let's see if they actually do. So you all think number 4 about hagfish are the only creatures known to have a skull but no vertebral column. You all agree with that one, and that one is science.
Oh boy. I almost came close to choosing.
So is it just so cartilage?
They don't have a vertebral column. No, they have a spinal cord, just no bones. So it's a skull and spinal cord, but no vertebral column.
So Steve, when you say vertebral column,
that's the bones. This will make a little bit more sense when I go over the other items. Because these all do tie together.
So you're gonna come back to it?
Let's go to number 3. Molecular analysis has confirmed that hagfish are transitional between vertebrates and invertebrates. You all also think that that one is science, and that one is the fiction.
Oh.
Sorry, guys. Recent molecular analysis has, in fact, shown the opposite, that it is not basal or transitional between vertebrates and invertebrates. It was thought that perhaps because of its morphology, etc., that it might be the closest living relative of the common ancestor, basal common ancestor to all vertebrates. That it essentially exists in that zone between vertebrates and invertebrates and might have given us a clue as to what the common ancestor of all vertebrates looked like. But molecular analysis showed that in fact it's a vertebrate. It's well within the vertebrate clade. In fact, it's related to the lamprey.
And now, so it's a vertebrate with no vertebral column.
Yes. Lamprey and hagfish are both part of the same clade, the jawless fish, or the agnathia.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so it's a jawless fish.
Make a horror movie about it and call it Jaws.
Jawless Jaws. So that leaves this huge gaping hole between vertebrates and invertebrates that we have nothing to fill.
Oops.
We don't know what the... obviously, whatever did fill that gap... All those creatures died out a long time ago. There's nothing survived to the current time.
See, so that's Steve. Therefore, evolution can't possibly be correct.
Right? We'll find. I'm sure we'll find some fossil species that fill that gap, but.
And then two new gaps will arise. Smaller ones.
All right, let's talk about
hagfish. Isn't it? We're getting there. The oldest fossil hagfish is 300 million years old and shows remarkable similarity to modern hagfish, demonstrating unusual evolutionary stability. That one is true. In fact,
I can't believe it.
As far as we know, there's only one fossil hagfish, and it looked very, very similar. Again, lending support, apparently, to the notion that it's a very basal creature. It's very primitive, if you will. There are some differences. It had other structures in the head, the fossil revealed tentacles, head structures, and internal organs. And no other fossils in this group, Myxinidae, has been reported. The fossil hagfish differed from living forms in the position of the gills, the feeding apparatus, and it had more developed eyes, actually.
Wow.
Than the living one, but otherwise it was very similar. So, showing a long conservative geological history. Conservation is the term for stable over evolutionary time.
Conservation, very good.
Conserved. Features are conserved. They last a long time throughout evolutionary history. Yeah, there were so many things I could have talked about with the hagfish. They have eye spots. You know, it's one of those creatures that has a very primitive but functional eye. Probably can see the direction of light, maybe make out sort of vague, shadowy forms, but can't focus. You know, doesn't have a lens or any of the other sophisticated structures of an eye. This also brings up another notion, and that is, the question was, does it have the form that it has, primitive eyes, skull but no vertebral column, because those are features that it had 300 million years ago, and they're essentially primitive, and they're basal to the vertebrate line, or is it degenerate? Did it lose these structures over evolutionary time? And now the thinking is that it's degenerate, that the hagfish is lost its vertebral column. Lost its eyes, you know, through its early evolution. So that it makes it look more primitive than it actually is. And that's why the molecular analysis, the molecular genetic analysis differed from the morphological analysis because it answered that question. It's not primitive, it's degenerate. Like parasites, for example, parasites often become much more simplified over time. They lose a lot of their structure. The hagfish is not a parasite, but it is a scavenger. It feeds on dead, you know, fish, dead carcasses at the bottom of the ocean. And in fact, it will often eat its way inside the creature and then eat it from the inside out.
Cool.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a jaw, but it does have a ring of teeth, that are made from keratinous teeth, which means that the hagfish can rapidly produce as much as 20 liters of slime as a defense against predators is science. And that's the one I was hoping to get you guys on, is the most surprising fact about it. I mean, we'll link to videos.
That's gotta be, disgusting?
Yeah, just like pulling slime off the hagfish. Just throwing off slime.
Oh my God.
And Jay, you're exactly correct. It secretes a protein that reacts with the salt water to produce the slime.
Good job, Jay.
So it greatly expands in volume once the protein is secreted. And, you know, this is a very active area of research. Look at the structure of this protein and maybe we could learn stuff about it.
It's not the only creature that does that. Anyway.
Yeah. And, there's also theories about how does the slime function as a defense mechanism. And it seems that the dominant theory is the gill clogging theory. It clogs up the gills of fish predators. But of course, it also can potentially clog up the gills of the hagfish itself. Yeah. So it has developed techniques to free itself from its own slime. It can sneeze and project out any slime that's in its gills. And it also curls up in a certain way that pushes all the slime off of its body. So it sort of escapes from the predator and the slime at the same time. Yeah, so it's a pretty cool little creature. It's obviously a very successful strategy. You know, that's been survived for 300 million years without much change because it's very successful at what it does.
And maybe we should have one on the show.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think we just did. That was tricky. It was tricky. You know, four
very
items
tricky.
Is always tricky and yeah, very unusual. If you didn't know about it, it's a really bizarre creature.
But if you had to pick a winner from tonight's game, Steve, who would it be?
Well, you definitely hit the nail on the head with the slime, Jay. So you do get some,
brownie points.
Honorable mention.
Thank you
for that. Even though you,
I'd agree. I agree with that. How about you, Bob?
We're wrong, and you lost. Yeah.
Not really. you know, the fiction was my second choice, so I think
I'm just going to say that.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Quote was sent in by MacGuffin. MacGuffin! Yeah.
Isn't that like when you screw up a golf swing and you take another swing?
I think that's a
mulligan.
A mulligan.
A mulligan, yeah.
Good one.
This is a quote by Samuel Arbsman. Does anybody know who Samuel Arbsman is?
I don't know that name. No.
He is a senior scholar in research and policy at the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation. Apparently this is a quote from a book that he wrote, and the quote is, "The web is great for finding a list of the 10 biggest cities in the United States, but if the scientific literature is merely littered with wrong facts, then cyberspace is an enticing quagmire of falsehoods, propaganda, and just plain bunkum. There simply is no substitute for skepticism."
Mm-hmm.
Samuel Arbsman!
Nice quote.
Sammy.
Pretty much says it all. The internet is a rat trap for bad information. You have to be a skeptic just to navigate yourself through the web and not get caught up in any of the BS that you'll find on there.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, finding sites that you trust, news sources that you trust, columnists that you trust, blogs that you trust, you know, and even still, you have to keep your skeptical radar up and functioning, because, you know, we even make mistakes on this show, and we're highly skeptical, but it happens. And you know, we welcome anybody's updates or better information, and when we can, we will let the audience know. And it's just the process of science.
Look, you know, absolutely. I mean, we share genetic traits with the hagfish. What can we say? We're flawed.
We're closely related to the hagfish.
Yeah.
Yeah, see? So, as people are listening to this, Steve, we're going to be at SciCon.
That's right. We're at SciCon as we speak. Hopefully having a good time. Probably at the SGU dinner or recording our private show.
Very cool.
Cool. But we'll be back. The next two episodes after this one will be the ones we recorded live at SciCon. Then we'll be back to our old schedule for the winter, because the next event after SciCon is going to be Nexus in April. It's a long time. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you,
Steve.
You're
welcome, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.